Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's episode is titled Music for the Birds. Birds have been a major source of inspiration for many compositions throughout music history. Composers often were not just inspired by the sounds of birds, but they actually tried to imitate some of their sounds in their music. We've heard some great examples of that today, from vocal music to instrumental music, and from the Renaissance through the Romantic era. We left off at the end of part one, right in the middle of the Romantic era. We had just heard an example of a bird-inspired composition, and this wasn't a composition where the bird sounds were being imitated, but where the music was supposed to depict the movement of the swan. So let's continue our discussion in the Romantic era. Later in the program, as promised, we will have a special guest to talk about bird song. He's been recognized in ornithology as the reigning expert in bird vocalization. So let's start this second half of our program with a composition that was intended to imitate the sounds of bird calls. And we'll go to a vocal example in this case. In his opera Hansel and Gretel, the late Romantic German composer Engelbert Humperdinck depicts the sounds of the lark and the rooster in a duet between the two title characters. In terms of story flow, this is after they sing that famous evening prayer duet that's commonly heard from this opera. Now it's time to wake up, and you'll hear the German language's representation of what these birds sound like. Gretel, a soprano, sings "Tirilirili" for the lark, and though we usually think of the rooster in English as a cock-a-doodle-doo, in German it's actually represented by the syllables "ki-kit-a-ki," which I think sounds a little bit more like a rooster than cock-a-doodle-doo. And those are the syllables sung by Hansel, the brother, which is a role for a mezzo-soprano. That's a woman singing Hansel. It's called a pants role, where a lower female plays the part usually of a young boy, as it's generally easier to represent the unchanged voice of a boy operatically through a mezzo-soprano instead of an opera company having to employ an actual prepubescent boy. At any rate, let's hear this soprano-mezzo-soprano duet from Hansel and Gretel, the imitation of the lark and rooster in this moment of the opera. You'll also hear the high violins and the treble wind instruments accompanying with bird-like accompaniment. Now I'm starting in the slower section of this duet where Gretel is first waking up and then she decides to wake Hansel up by imitating a bird. This recording features soprano Edita Grubarova and mezzo-soprano Anne Murray. Thank you. That was soprano Edita Gruborova, mezzo-soprano Anne Murray, and the Staatskapelle Dresden with Sir Colin Davis performing a duet from Humperdinck's opera Hansel and Gretel, where the two children imitate the sounds of birds in their singing. And we heard imitations of the lark and the rooster. As we move now into the 20th century, we see a work by the Italian composer Ottorino Respighi, who is most well known for his tone poem titled Pines of Rome. This is the second orchestral work in Respighi's Roman trilogy. The work, which premiered in 1924, was written to capture impressions of nature. The four-movement Pines of Rome depicts pine trees in different locations around Rome at different times of the day. The third movement is particularly unique. Respighi wrote this piece to represent a moonlit scene with nightingales singing. Now, you could say maybe the composer was using the clarinet solo to represent the nightingales, but actually, he did something more explicit to represent bird calls. He actually required that a recording of the nightingale be played at the end of the movement. Let's hear this third movement of the Pines of Rome, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with Fritz Reiner conducting, and in this recording you'll actually hear a recording of nightingales inserted at the end. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for the Birds, and in it we are exploring the many fowl-inspired compositions of music history, specifically composers imitating bird sounds and bird song in their work. Fritz Reiner conducted the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in that recording of Ottorino Respighi's tone poem, The Pines of Rome, the third movement. That movement was to represent a moonlit evening with nightingales singing. The piece premiered in 1924, and the composer actually requested a recording of the nightingale be played at the end of the movement. And so about 5 minutes in, the clarinet plays that main theme, and then a recording of the nightingale was incorporated into that recording. So that's a unique way a composer infused birdsong into his compositions, not just the instruments imitating the sounds of birds, but an actual recording of actual birds. Another composer from the 20th century who depicted birds in his music was French composer Maurice Ravel. Now, I'll say again, this is not just a piece about birds, because there are many pieces of music like that. This one intended to imitate the sounds of birds in the music. This is from a 5-movement suite for solo piano entitled Miroir, composed in 1904 and 1905. Each movement was dedicated to a member of a French avant-garde artist group from the early 20th century. The second movement of the suite is titled Oiseaux Tristes, which means sad birds, and it represents a lone bird whistling a melancholy tune. The lone bird is then joined by several other birds, but the lonely, somber melody returns again at the end. Ravel said this about the piece: "It evokes birds lost in the oppressiveness of a very dark forest during the hottest hours of the summer." Here is pianist Robert Cassadesus performing Ravel's Oiseaux Tristes.
Thank you.
Those were some sad birds we just heard in the second movement of Maurice Ravel's piano suite Miroir, that movement being titled Oiseaux Tristes, or Sad Birds. It was performed by pianist Robert Kasidisis. The title indicates that the movement is about birds, but the music is also meant to depict the sounds of birds. Today we have heard various instruments being used to imitate these bird songs. In that example, we heard a piano. And of course, the piano was playing in more of the treble register to imitate the bird sounds. In a couple of examples, the human voice was used to imitate the birds. In the case of Vivaldi's Four Seasons, we heard the treble sounds of the solo violin. In Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, we heard wind instruments like the flute, oboe, and clarinet being employed for bird sounds. And it probably doesn't surprise you that a composer would use these treble wind instruments, particularly the flute, because of its similar tone color to the whistle-like sound of many songbirds. So when Sergei Prokofiev set out to tell the story of Peter and the Wolf through the instruments of the orchestra, he used the flute to imitate the bird of the story. Prokofiev also uses the oboe to imitate the duck in Peter and the Wolf. I've played these examples before on this program, but I want to play a different section today. This is a part of the story where the bird and duck have a discussion that turns into an argument. Then when a cat shows up and spooks the two birds, you hear how each responds. Listen to how Prokofiev uses the flute and oboe duet to depict these two foul creatures. This is narrated by Patrick Stewart with the Lyon Opera Orchestra, with Kent Nagano conducting.
Seeing the duck, the little bird flew down upon the grass, settled next to her, and shrugged his shoulders. "What kind of a bird are you if you can't fly?" said he. To this, the duck replied, "What kind of a bird are you if you can't swim?" and dived into the pond. Argued and argued, the duck swimming in the pond, the little bird hopping along the shore. Suddenly, something caught Peter's attention. He noticed a cat crawling through the grass. Thought, "The bird is busy arguing. I'll just grab him." Stealthily, she crept towards him on her velvet paws. "Look out!" shouted Peter. And the bird immediately flew up into the tree. while the duck quacked angrily at the cat. From the middle of the pond.
That was a segment from Sergei Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf, performed by the Lyon Opera Orchestra with Kent Nagano conducting, narrated by Patrick Stewart. And it was an example of birds being explicitly depicted in a musical composition, in this case a bird and a duck being depicted by a flute and an oboe, respectively. In that segment of the story, they were having a conversation, then an argument, until they were frightened by the cat. And today on Music for Life, in this episode titled Music for the Birds, we are exploring the many fowl-inspired compositions of music history, specifically composers imitating bird sounds and bird song in their work. Now, for a unique look at this subject of the music of the birds, let's get into our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. Our guest today isn't one who is performing on the concert circuit in the traditional sense, but he is helping us better understand a concert going on around us every single day somewhere in the world. Since we've talked so much about how the songs of birds have impacted composers throughout music history, it's only fitting that we talk with someone about the actual study of bird song itself. So to do that, I talked via Skype connection with one of the world's foremost authorities on this subject. He is the author of several books and hundreds of articles. Interviews with him have been published and heard in many notable media, from Scientific American issues to NPR programs. And the American Ornithologist Union has called him the, quote, reigning authority on the biology of avian vocal behavior, unquote. Please welcome to the program Dr. Donald Kruidsma. What I think is interesting about nature is obviously that a lot of animals have voices, but when we talk about birds and a couple other types of animals, we talk about them in terms of song. You know, we say the birds are singing. We use a lot of musical terms. I notice in your research, even there are musical terms that pop out, and I'd like to just get an overview from you on some of your findings and even just highlight some of these musical terms that keep popping up, terms like repertoire and range and duration and tempo and modulation, those types of things, chorus. You know, we see those commonly coming up in what you're doing. So maybe you could talk first about repertoire. What is the repertoire size per bird species? Does a bird have one song or several, or does it vary from bird to bird?
Oh, it varies within a species, among species. And when we break down repertoires, we tend to think of, for many birds, maybe half the birds in the world, we think of songs and calls.
Okay.
And maybe birds have roughly a dozen different calls, though that reflects more our human tendency to categorize things that are continuous, but maybe they have a dozen different calls. And then the song is what typically, at least in the north temperate zone here, North America, is what a male uses to defend a territory and try to impress females. So when we think about song repertoires, my, it runs the gamut from one song per individual to literally thousands in an individual. And the brain sizes are different too, the little brain areas that control songs. In this brown thrasher that can sing a couple of thousand songs, his brain is just perfectly adapted for storing and memorizing and improvising thousands of different songs. So varies thousands. Enormously among species.
That's amazing. A bird would have, you know, thousands of songs. Is the brown thrasher the one that has the most?
It's the one that's been studied that has the most, but I think he's special in a couple of ways. He's closely related to the mockingbird, and the mockingbird imitates, he mimics other species, and at most he may have 200 different songs in his repertoire. Average is about 100. But a brown thrasher, I'm convinced he has a lot of songs stored in memory that he can come back to and sing, but I think he can make them up on the spot too. I think if you play a unique song to him, I think he can come back with that song. And that may sound rather remarkable, but Ryan, you can make up a word in the English language, and I know enough about the English language that I could repeat that entirely novel word back to you, And I think these thrashers are doing the same thing in their heated exchanges early in the season before sunrise, when things really count.
So that's more of the imitative ability or an improvisatory ability, you could say. Before we get into improvisation and that type of thing, how many different tempos, moods, dynamics, durations, tone colors could be within these, you know, hundreds or thousands of songs? Say a bird has all these different songs in its repertoire. Talk about the variance that could be from song to song.
Oh, we could go straight to that brown thrasher again. The word theme and variations, I think, is also another musical term. Mm. And the theme for this brown thrasher is singing twos. If you had to put a mnemonic to it, you'd probably say, good morning, good morning. How are you? How are you? That's fine. That's fine. Very well. Very well. So that is the theme, the two-ness, and the variations. He has just this endless number of different kinds of ways he can say things in twos. Tempos. Birds can change the rate at which they sing an individual song. They can put more space between the syllables, or they can hurry things up, all depending upon their mood. Tanagers are excellent at this. During the dawn chorus, the songs are very deliberate and measured, and they may slip in a call. But during the daytime, they'll sing a rapid song, pause 5 seconds, sing another rapid song. Moods, warblers illustrate this beautifully. Warblers, many warblers have two different songs. One they use during aggressive encounters. During the dawn chorus, they chip wildly between the songs. And as soon as all that dawn business is over, they have a mood change that goes to their day song, which is the song they use more with courting females. So just by listening to which song the male is using, I wouldn't exactly call it mind reading, but you know what's on his mind. You know the mood of the bird. I could go on here. Durations. There's a bird called the chipping sparrow, and one might say he has just one song. Each male has just one song. Listen to him during the daytime. You might hear a 5 second long song. Chip, 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 chip. But during the dawn chorus, instead of up in the tree as he is during the daytime, he's sitting on the ground. He joins a little arena of other males, and they sing at each other within wings length almost. And they may sputter 60 of these songs, chip, 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 60 of these songs a minute, and just kind of machine gun-like fire. So these birds are just extraordinarily expressive with what they have. They can change so much, and we can change the intonation of a single word, and it can mean so many different things. And right. We haven't really discovered what the birds are doing with all of these minor variations, but they're certainly there. They are expressive. They are as expressive as we are with our English language, I'm quite sure.
And then the tone that they're using, some of the tones that we would interpret humanly, we would say, well, that sounds like a musical tone, like a whistle or a flute. And then some of them are quite different than, say, any of our instruments. Maybe talk about some of the difference in tone colors.
Tone, yeah. A lot of birds have what sound like just pure tones. It's just the black-capped chickadee or a white-throated sparrow. I'm not coming up with good examples for Oklahoma right now, but a lot of these whistles are just pure tone, and then other sounds are very noisy. Mm-hmm. And definition of noise, I think, is that you just have a lot of frequencies occurring simultaneously, like a woodpecker slamming its bill into a tree or a gunshot. Mm-hmm. And a bird singing a given song, he might alternate very nice pure tones in a song with what sound to us like rather harsh sounds. But I emphasize what sounds to us like harsh sounds because these birds can hear so much better than we can. We slow their songs down maybe 8 or 10 times. I'm convinced we are starting to hear what they hear, and what sounds noisy to our ears can sound entirely different and pure tone to them.
And that's a wonderful resource you have on your website where you play some of these bird calls but also slow them down. As you said, it gives us that idea of what they might be hearing, or it sounds more like music to us when we slow it down in that way.
Yes, when we slow them down, I take a wood thrush. Wood thrush is just one of the wonders of eastern woodlands, and we listen to the song and we hear two parts. The first part is slow enough that we hear just beautiful tone, pure tone sounds jumping about the scale. And the last part just sounds percussive. It sounds harsh. But then you look at what you might call a musical score for bird song. We call them sonograms.
Mm-hmm.
You look at this musical score and you say, wow, he has two voices he's using simultaneously. Now, because they're non-harmonically related, so there are two voice boxes that he is using simultaneously. Most birds have these two voice boxes, and most of them use them in succession. But when you see them used simultaneously, you know it's left and right. And so you slow this song, the second part of the song that sounds percussive to us, slow it down to where we think we have it slow enough that the bird, we're hearing the details the bird can hear. And then you hear the most beautiful, stunning music of two voices interacting with each other. So our ears aren't fair to the birds for what they're actually producing.
Right. But like you said, you have these sonograms, which to me as a musician, I'm looking on your website and seeing, wow, that looks a lot like a staff. And here are the pitches of the staff. That certainly helps us to put in concrete terms what they're doing.
Yeah, all these sonograms, the ability to see what these birds are doing. You can read a human musical score, but I can't. But I look at these sonograms and I just see extraordinary things that are going on. You know, the difference in tones, the frequency leaps. We can get recordings of this bird from Costa Rica, the three wild bellbird, and document that those sharp, pure whistles in the 1970s have dropped about 50 cycles per second each year, so that they're down about 3,500 hertz now. They've dropped that much per year, and to be able to put numbers on what these birds are doing from graphing these songs and studying them is just a wonderful insight into their world.
And this idea of being able to graph them and say, okay, this bird is singing this song, and then now it's singing the same song, but on a different, starting on a different pitch. In music, we call that modulation. You have the same set of pitches in terms of their relationship, but you start on a different reference pitch. How much is modulation happening in birdsong?
There's one species, the black-capped chickadee, all the way across the country, and I think it's been best studied there. It's a very simple song consisting of a couple of pure-toned whistles. And my favorite mnemonic is, hey, sweetie. And I'm getting the pitch all wrong there. A musician would just listen to that and listen to the bird just laugh at me. But the idea is that there's a high whistle and there's a lower whistle that has two syllables. So, hey, sweetie. And if you measure the pitch of the hey and the sweetie, you find out that this bird will sing on one pitch for a while and then he'll drop it. And he'll sing there for a while. And the frequency ratio of those two whistles stays roughly the same.
Mm.
Not the frequency difference, but the frequency ratio.
Right.
And so he has a whole range of frequencies. You might say he has just one song, the Hey Sweetie, but he transposes that through a whole range of frequencies. And during the dawn chorus, when he's really excited, he'll jump around more often. Later in the day, he might sing 100 or so songs on one pitch, and it might take forever for you to hear him to transpose to another frequency.
That's remarkable that they're doing that. You even talked earlier about them improvising. How do they improvise?
Well, we talked a little about the brown thrasher. I'm convinced he's improvising so that when we record all that he sings over an hour or so, we find that, well, there are about 2,000 different songs that he sang. Paired couplings, these twosomes, about 2,000 that he sang in that hour, but many of those songs occurred only once and may never occur again. Then there's a bird called the sedge wren. When birds sing in very stable communities and they know their neighbors and they're going to sing with those neighbors throughout their life, these songbirds that are so specialized for imitating tend to learn precisely the song of those neighbors so that they can sing and countersing, and they can match each other's songs exactly. The sedge wren is more of a nomad, and it moves all over the continent. It might breed up in Saskatchewan, during early May and come down to Nebraska, maybe get down as far as Oklahoma in August. And they don't imitate. They are remarkable in how they improvise their songs. Each male makes up 100, maybe 200 different songs. And I compare his songs to snowflakes. You look at each song, each one you listen to an individual song and it says, I'm a Sedgren. But if you look at the sonograms, these musical scores, the details of those songs, you can't find any two alike. So they're just master improvisers.
When we talk about ensemble in birdsong, are some singing together like a chorus where there's some unity in what they're doing, or is it more of an individual endeavor that they're all doing at the same time, so it's kind of creating what musicians would call a polyphony?
I think mostly it's an individual performance. And if you listen carefully to an individual singing and then listen to who is singing around him, they tend to alternate songs rather than overlap. So I think there's a real effort for an individual to get his message out there. And to do so, he avoids overlapping the songs of other species that might be singing in the neighborhood. You can see them adjust their timing so that they don't interfere with each other. There are some birds where you kind of scratch your head and you say, wow, they're like a least flycatcher, or these chipping sparrows that I mentioned that gather at dawn. And instead of each male singing on his territory that you'd see throughout the day, at dawn they gather in these little arenas where, you know, four birds, for example, might be singing at each other. But they're still, I think it's an individual performance. It's not a group performance that is intended to be coordinated in any kind of fashion to influence listeners in any special way. I still think it's the individual trying to achieve his best to place himself in a male hierarchy so he impresses females in a certain way. So I think it's mostly individual.
Okay. On my program, I always have an educational segment called Classroom Corner, where I usually talk about how young people learn music. But let's talk about some birds, how they're taught particular songs. We find that in this component of nature, and it's really fascinating to me, you found that some species' songs are the same throughout life, but then others' songs develop as they mature. So are birds learning, so to speak, from their older counterparts, and are they practicing, as we might term it?
These songbirds that we talked about, true songbirds, the one with the specialized brains and the complex voice boxes, they are specialized at imitating songs of other individuals. So when a young bird is with, and let's talk about typical North American birds where only the male sings. The females in most of these species don't sing, and that's immediately upsetting to about half of the listeners, half of the human listeners who say, isn't it a pity that the females don't sing? But, well, they do in the tropics, but there's one very nice twist to add to this, and that is that I think of the females as the silent composers of everything the male is singing, because she chooses the singer for the father of her offspring. She passes on his genes, so it is by her choice what all these males are singing. So we have all the females to thank for everything that we hear, and it's a huge thank you I offer to these non-singing females. So in a lot of these species, these true songbirds are specialized at learning. Those young birds are listening to dad sing. They memorize, they listen, and then they practice. They babble. A young bird babbles just like a human baby babbles, because both the young bird and the human child are listening to their own sounds as they produce these sounds and trying to match what they're saying or singing with what's already stored in their brain. So a lot of these birds, these songbirds, they imitate in remarkable precision what adults around them are singing. Once they leave home, they give priority to the songs where they might set up. And this is what I did for my doctoral thesis many, many, many years ago. I followed baby birds as they left home and recorded their songs and recorded the songs of all the males throughout this large refuge out in Oregon. and discovered that, yes, in fact, even though they could learn Dad's songs, they rejected all of Dad's songs for the little micro mini dialect of songs where they would set up their territory and stay for life. But then there are the flip sides, too. There's the whole closely related group to songbirds. We call them flycatchers. Scissor-tailed flycatcher is probably the state bird of Oklahoma.
That's right.
I hope I have that
right. That's right.
I'll insult your listeners if I'm wrong. But the scissor-tailed flycatcher, like eastern kingbird, western kingbird, these birds do not learn their songs. Their brains are different. Their voice boxes are simpler. And their songs are built right into the genes somehow. The songs are what we call innate. So a very different way of accomplishing singing as an adult, no learning involved, but still equally successful. They can trace their genes all the way back to the beginning of time, just as any true songbird can.
So some songbirds, their song is their song for their lives. And then some, as you said, you studied in your doctoral thesis, they were changing. They were imitating. They were taking a cue from Dad, as you said.
Yeah, most of the change for these songbirds occurs during the first year of life. They listen, they practice. When they're a couple of months old, you can start to hear them practicing when they're about a month old. Just faint little whisperings, and then they get louder and bolder. And by the time they're a year old, most of these songbirds have settled on the song or songs that they will use throughout life. I recorded a red-winged blackbird, for example, one bird over a span of 5 years, and he had exactly the same five songs throughout those years. But a mockingbird's going to change his songs. He's going to add more songs as he ages. He'll drop some song, maybe drop five and add 10 per year or something like that. These bellbirds I talked about in Costa Rica, they are continually relearning their songs as they listen to their neighbors and change their songs throughout their life, which could span 25 years. So there's a lot of variation among birds, and whether they learn songs during only the first year or throughout their lives, there's no such thing as the bird when you start talking about all the variety of things that they can do. You know, deep down, we like to think there's some universal aspect to human music and what birds do. We apply, as you pointed out at the beginning, we apply all these human musical terms to what birds are doing. Birds sing, and the very word sing pretty much says it all.
Well, Don, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate just everything you've talked with us about today.
My pleasure, Ryan.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music for the Birds, and in it we are exploring the many fowl-inspired compositions of music history, specifically composers imitating bird sounds and bird song in their work. That was an interview that I had with Dr. Donald Kruidsma, one of the foremost authorities on birdsong. And if you are interested in hearing the variety of bird sounds that he's recorded, you can visit his website, donaldkruidsma.com. That's DonaldKruidsma.com. We'll also have that linked in our show notes. It has some amazing resources where you can not only hear the birds, but as mentioned in the interview, he also has some of the bird songs slowed down to a speed where humans can hear the frequencies more clearly. Also, as mentioned, you can see sonograms of the particular bird calls as well. It's a great resource. You can check that out. Remember also that you can follow this show on Twitter for interesting links and updates. Just follow at Music for Life PCG, at Music for Life PCG. We also have a Facebook page to post similar things. You can go to facebook.com/musicforlifepcg. All of our programs are archived at kpcg.fm and on iTunes. All our programs are also archived along with some other audio clips on our SoundCloud page. And if you are enjoying the program, please consider giving us a certain number of stars rating on iTunes, clicking the like symbol on SoundCloud or Facebook, or even writing a review if you feel so inclined. You are also obviously welcome to send us your comments or feedback directly. There's a feedback link on our program's webpage at kpcg.fm. Finally, let's have our dessert for today's episode, where we hear a related example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program. Now, there are a vast number of pop songs and folk songs that are about birds. One of the most famous figures of popular music in the 20th century was the jazz legend Charlie Parker. Early in his career, he picked up the nickname Yard Bird, later shortened to Bird. There's some question over how exactly he got that nickname, but regardless, it stuck, and we commonly refer to this saxophone virtuoso from the bebop era of jazz simply as Bird. One of his most famous compositions is titled after the word meaning the study of birds. It was a melody written over an existing chord progression used in the song How High the Moon, but it remains one of the most popular and most frequently performed bebop tunes ever. So to end our program today, let's enjoy Charlie Parker's, or Bird's, Ornithology. You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.